All right. Thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And this is Craig Lubow today. I am with my guest, Lauren Bonds. Lauren is the legal director of the Kansas chapter, the ACLU, which is American Civil Liberties Union. She's been there since September 2017, and she is also currently functioning as the interim director overall of the chapter while they search for somebody to replace Micah Kubik. Welcome, Lauren.
Hi, Craig. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So we want to talk about, let's start out, what are the issues that we can look forward to ACLU working on in Kansas during 2019?
So I think they're going to be very similar to some of our issues that we've been working on in the past. So the three main areas where we're going to be working this year are going to be on criminal justice reform, voting rights, and what we call safe and welcoming legislation, which mainly is focused here in Wyandotte County to get municipal IDs for folks.
All right. So you said, let's start with criminal justice.
Sure.
What do you think is going to happen in reform issues on that?
So we obviously have some ideas about what we want to happen. You know, one of our major focuses in the legislature this year is going to be finding ways to increase the use of diversion and making sure that certain offenses are presumptive diversion offenses. Right now, that's something where there is almost entirely unfettered discretion for prosecutors. And diversion is the pretrial process through which you can be diverted towards mental health and drug treatment services as opposed to going to trial and getting convicted and going to jail. So we really want to focus on increasing that use of diversion. You know, we're also very focused on defelonizing possession of marijuana and other low-level drugs. So that's really our bucket of criminal justice work for the legislative session this year. And, you know, obviously we have a couple of cases pending. As the legal director, I always want to talk about our cases, too. So we currently have a diversion case pending against Larry Markle, who's the county attorney of Montgomery County. And that is simply for him to comply with the current diversion statute, which requires that you give all criminal defendants in your county that you're prosecuting notice of your diversion program. And so we have a mandamus petition just essentially asking him to start providing that notice. And so we'll keep doing that this year.
And let me ask you, is every county mandated to have a diversion program?
Everyone has to have a diversion program. It has to be written, and all defendants have to get written notice of it. And it seems like most counties at least have some form of a diversion program, whether it's publicized, whether it's consistent, are more of the issues we've been seeing.
All right. And so you're saying that they have to give written notice to the defendant that there is a diversion program?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I practice in Wyandotte County.
Yes.
And I don't think my clients routinely get that notice. Usually what has happened in the past is if it's a diversion-eligible case, then the prosecutor will notify the attorney, and then we talk to our client about it. But I don't recall my clients just getting written notification they have that program.
Yeah, and so I won't say too much about Wyandotte because I do think that their county or their district attorney is making pretty great strides towards towards improving diversion use in his county. And I hope things are improving there, but you'd be surprised how many counties aren't compliant. And for, you know, defendants who are diversion eligible, who don't retain counsel, they're really the ones who are in the dark and don't know that they have this opportunity to apply and basically get a second chance without getting a conviction on their record.
And where, you said there's a case against prosecutor from Montgomery County, where in the proceedings are you at this point?
So we are in the pretrial proceedings there. So we originally filed it with the Supreme Court of Kansas. They said it needed to go to the district court for further fact development. So we're getting geared up for that right now.
Okay. The other question in criminal justice that you didn't mention, are you working on, no pun intended, the bond program there to eliminate cash and surety bonds in low-level cases?
Yeah, so that's definitely something we're looking at. I don't know if we have as much of a formulated plan around that as we do defelonization and diversion, but that's definitely something we're looking very close at. I know that the Kansas Supreme Court and the appellate court have convened a task force to look at bail use and bond use in Kansas, and they've invited us to be part of that conversation. And so we're hopeful we can, you know, kind of see how things go through that process and see what our next steps are from there based on what we're able to do kind of through an institutional framework.
And is ACLU working? I know that's an issue that Appleseed works on a lot. Are you working with them at all too?
So we are always in conversation with them. We're always looking at ways to collaborate. They've really been leading on that work, and we've been, you know, trying to stay up to speed and provide support where it makes sense at this point.
Okay. The other issue you mentioned, the voting rights.
Yeah.
So,
got a lot going on there.
We've had several shows talking about the lawsuits against Chris Kobach.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to have you update us on that.
Sure.
And if there's a chance that with him losing the governorship and not being in office at all, is there a chance that case is going to go away, or is somebody going to pick up the mantle for him and press forward anyway?
So that's a very good question. So the main case that we've been litigating against the Secretary of State's office was a case called Fish v. Kobach, which is a documentary proof of citizenship. That was the case challenging the documentary proof of citizenship requirement for voter registration, just so everyone has the background. So that case actually is on appeal to the 10th Circuit. You know, the Attorney General's office took over the appeals process, you know, at the trial level. It was the Secretary of State and his legal counsel that was litigating the case. So after we won at the district court level, they appealed and the AG's office took over. And so, you know, they filed their opening brief. We filed our response around Thanksgiving. And, you know, since the election results have come out, they filed their reply brief. So I think that's some indication that the case is going to go forward. We have oral argument set in that case for March 18th. So I think if the case were to go away, we would know pretty soon here, I think. But we really haven't gotten that sense so far. It's, you know, not within the discretion, to my knowledge, it's not within the discretion of the governor to withdraw from that case. You know, she would have influence over that. She could try to use her influence, but it's really the Secretary of State's decision. And we've gotten no indication that Secretary Schwab now is planning to withdraw the case. So.
Okay. It would be up to him or to the Attorney General?
It would be up to Secretary Schwab. And I couldn't tell you what, I mean, I imagine the Attorney General's office supports the Secretary of State. They're just mainly acting as his counsel.
All right. And what are some of the other voting issues that might come up between now and 2020? Because we had quite a few through the whole country that popped up, and is there some of that that's going to filter into Kansas?
You know, that's a good question. And so, you know, right before the end of 2018, we came out with a Democracy is Local report that really focused on the practices of county clerks and county election commissioners and their influence over ballot access and voting rights. And so I think what we really saw, and this is consistent with a case that we filed right before the election, which was against the county clerk of Ford County, is that, you know, county clerks are, as much as the Secretary of State was kind of driving statewide policy that was at times infringing on people's right to vote, we're seeing a lot of practices, you know, throughout the state at the county level, where, you know, similar practices that are illegal that are keeping certain segments of the population from voting. And so I really think that, you know, I can't predict what exactly is going to happen between now and 2020. This, I think, will be a really interesting year for, you know, kind of voter registration issues and voter drives, and, you know, we'll get some of the primaries as well. I can't really predict with 100% certainty, but I do think our focus is going to turn more local as opposed to kind of statewide. And, you know, a lot of the issues that were popping up across the country were kind of these local fights. You know, there were definitely statewide fights or even federal issues, but we really do think that that's going to be where our voting rights work is going to be in the next year.
And what is Kansas, or what is ACLU doing to make sure Kansas does not have the issues that Georgia had, and I think it was North Carolina, one of the Carolinas, where there was allegedly massive voter fraud.
Right.
And it was supposedly, allegedly again, committed by the people on the Republican side.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't know if there is a national strategic plan to prevent that going forward. I mean, I think it's really important that there's just vigilance. And so, you know, one way that we are, you know, making sure that we're keeping the lines of communication open so we can learn about those things is we had a election protection hotline during the election. You know, we get reports to that hotline throughout the year. They get forwarded to us from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And so I think just making sure that we have kind of this open dialogue with the public and with voters, so, you know, we can catch those things as they're happening.
And tell me how, because I know some other organizations have conducted those election protection hotlines or in the past. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Because if somebody calls you and let's say they're standing outside the voting booth and somebody's trying to stop them from voting.
Yeah.
What are you able to do at that point?
So it really depends on what county they're in. I think we've been more effective in some counties than others, just kind of based off of, you know, how direct of line we have to, you know, someone in the election commissioner's office or the clerk's office. But a lot of the times, and this was definitely true during the general election, we were able to get the, you know, county clerk on the phone and say, hey, this is happening at this polling location. And most of the time it'd be something that's pretty clear, like, yes, they can use that ID to vote. Yes, they should be, you know, still registered there. And they'd be able to make sure that happened. And usually it would be us saying, you know, we've got in touch with the person. Just stay in line. Stay there. You're going to get a vote. And that worked out for the most part in a number of situations, I would say. And then, you know, for folks who, you know, do have to leave, aren't able to stay there, usually we direct them or suggest and advise that they've cast a provisional ballot, and we'll help them follow up after, before the canvass, but after the election's over, because you can still correct defects with your ballot during that time. And I think most people that we've assisted in that manner have been able to make their vote count.
All right. Let's move a little bit to the safe and welcoming.
Yes.
And also, let me ask you, in regard to all of these issues, besides litigation, will there also be lobbying efforts to lobby the new legislature?
Absolutely. And so, you know, I spoke about a couple of them in the Smart Justice campaign that we're working on, or the criminal justice reform work. You know, in voting rights, we think a lot of the problems that people face voting can be cured with Election Day registration and, you know, with other, you know, pretty easy fixes that a lot of other states have. And so we're pushing legislation, as we've pushed in past years, to see if we can get that done at the state level, so we don't have such a strong focus on kind of local practices. If we have, you know, a certain number of days where advanced voting is standardized across the state, if there is Election Day registration, you know, if there's permanent advance mail ballot access, so, you know, people don't have to apply every single time they want to vote by mail. We think that's going to make voting more accessible to everyone. And so that's definitely, you know, something we're pushing for in the form of legislation, in addition to our litigation to make these things easier. And we also have a legislative fix for the documentary proof of citizenship requirement that would essentially repeal that. So it's possible the case could be moot if that were passed. But yeah, so we're trying to hit it at every angle.
And you mentioned that Laura Kelly, of course, she just in her position alone, she can't order or withdraw from the suit.
Mm-hmm.
What about, does the legislature have the authority to vote on that and withdraw?
So because it is a piece of legislation that was passed in part of the Kansas statute that's, you know, obviously not being enforced right now, but it is part of the Kansas statute, that's something they could repeal and Laura Kelly could sign off on. So they would have power to influence the outcome of that case in that respect.
Okay. So let's go to the, we started with the, and then got sidetracked,
yeah,
safe and welcoming.
Yeah, so safe and welcoming, that, you know, more than litigation or, you know, kind of more traditional state legislature lobbying is really a local grassroots effort that the ACLU of Kansas is, you know, supporting and pushing, and that is to make sure that everyone within Wyandotte County is able to get a municipal ID. And the, you know, there's a lot of reasons that a municipal ID would be helpful, and there's a lot of populations a municipal ID would help. So, you know, one of the more obvious ones is, you know, a municipal ID would support and help, you know, immigrants who aren't able to get driver's license to have a form of identification. You know, it also helps other people who, you know, aren't probably going to be able to get driver's license, and there are costs associated with driver's license there wouldn't be associated with a municipal ID. So, you know, the homeless population, I think, would benefit from it. You know, elderly people who don't drive anymore and don't have a need to go back and get their driver's license renewed. And we think this will definitely help people, you know, access health care, be able to report crimes, and just all the other services where identification is either necessary or helpful for processing, you know, those requests.
One of the counties out west, and I think it's where Dodge City is.
Fort, yeah.
Is predominantly immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very large Hispanic population, which surprised me why they would settle in the very conservative area of the state.
There's a lot of jobs out there.
And one of the things they did during the election was to shut down all of the polls, basically, and they had to, I guess, go to the next county, or
you had to go outside of the city. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and I was there litigation to try to fix that right before the election, and what happened with that?
Yeah, so the ACLU of Kansas, we and the National ACLU for the temporary restraining order period, right, the emergency litigation we filed, we did file a lawsuit under Title II of the vote, or Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, alleging that this limited polling location that was outside of the city that was inaccessible by bus and other forms of public transportation was disenfranchising voters. And so we filed it on behalf of the LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, and an 18-year-old young man who's from Dodge City. It was his first time voting, Alex Ranga Lopez. And so, unfortunately, we got the case in a little too late. It was too close to the election for the judge to want to make any changes or add any polling locations. And so the single polling location that was outside the city stayed in place. You saw much lower in-person turnout rates as a result. And, you know, it wasn't a good situation. So, you know, we're persisting with the case. Our clients wanted to persist with the case with the objective of making sure that there's more than one polling location to begin with. And, you know, those polling locations aren't outside the city. They're where people live and they're where people can access if they don't have, if they don't have their own forms of transportation and if they don't have cars. So, we're soldiering on there.
And you also mentioned you're pushing for same-day registration.
Yeah.
How, if somebody wanted to register same day, would that be at the polling booth where they, the polling precinct that they would be assigned to?
Yeah. So that would be, you know, if someone moved out of their past precinct, if their past precinct where they used to vote at, or if, you know, someone just didn't vote for, you know, two federal elections and got, you know, properly purged from the rolls, they would be able to register that day and vote again. Or if there was some problem with their registration that they weren't aware of, you know, that wouldn't prevent them from casting a regular ballot. They could just re-register at the polling location.
Okay.
And so, you know, Kansas, I think, is 48th out of 50 in terms of the number of provisional ballots that are cast. And that's in large part due to the fact that we don't have same-day registration.
All right. So when you say 40 out of 50...
We have the most in terms of having...
We have the most provisional
yes.
ballots. Okay.
So I guess we're one out of... Or three out of... number three.
All right. And... what are the requirements? When are they required to actually count the provisional ballots?
So, you know, it really depends on the reason that the person is directed to cast a provisional ballot. So if there's, you know, a registration flaw, so, you know, you, the person who's looking through the poll book can't find them in the poll book at whatever polling location they're at. So that would be, you know, maybe something where they'd be able to go and show, like, oh, for whatever reason, I just wasn't. Like, they go back and they check it with Elvis or some other database and say, oh, for whatever reason, it didn't get transferred to, you know, the copy we have here. Those kind of clerical errors happen, you know, somewhat frequently. So, you know, that would be something that the county clerk and their staff could check and be able to determine that, you know, a provisional ballot would count. And that wouldn't require any, you know, efforts by the voter. Other than checking in and making sure it happens. You know, if it's a situation where they had, they didn't have photo ID, they could provide a photo ID between the election and the canvas, and then their ballot would count. If it was, you know, a clerical error by the driver's license or the DMV, that's also something that they would be able to show. So it's just kind of, it really does depend on what the quote-unquote error was with their ballot in the first place.
All right. So one of the things I was thinking of when I asked that, though, was, I don't know what the numbers was, but hypothetically in the third district in the election.
Sure.
Let's assume that Sharice Davids from the regular ballots that were counted was 30,000 votes ahead of Yoder.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's assume that there were only 20,000 provisional ballots.
Oh, okay.
So that it would, would they still be required to count those even though it would be impossible for it to impact the election?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think typically just because, and especially in the third district, there's just so many races on the ballot that there would be, you know, some ballots that, it would lead to some ballots getting counted just because there's going to probably be a close enough race that could be determined there. But I mean, in a situation like that, if they, it was like a special election or something and they were the only two on the ballot, I would be surprised if those actually got counted. So,
okay. All right, let me move to another issue. New Governor Kelly signed. It sounded like it must be an executive order, and it was either yesterday or today prohibiting discrimination against LGBT people, and. Are you familiar with what the order is and how broad it is?
Yeah, so I don't know if I haven't actually read the order. I believe it came out today, or at least I saw it in the news today. It was reported today. My understanding is it protects state workers and state employees.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it is much broader than that in terms of people, you know, trying to access state, you know, resources and benefits. I don't think it covers those individuals. So I think it really is limited into what is her kind of capacity and purview as the executive of the state, and that I think only extends to employees.
All right. And let me have you address a little bit about immigration issues.
I will do my best.
Um, There's so many issues. Yeah. Let me hand you this. Like,
I'll see if I know
where
the
to start. But yeah. Why don't I just have you generically talk about some of the immigration issues that ACLU might be working on in Kansas?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a good question. And I think a lot of our work right now is very much geared towards being proactive. And that's mainly manifested in our Safe and Welcoming campaign here in Wyandotte County. And, you know, we do have, you know, broader ambitions to maybe go other places. So, you know, I think that's making sure that, you know, that there's some form of resource and recourse for individuals who maybe are undocumented or otherwise don't have access to municipal IDs that they can get them. And, you know, I think in terms of outside of kind of what's our proactive work, we have some reactive work that, you know, we're hoping that we'd be willing to do if there was, you know, negative legislation that came up in during this legislative session, whether that's, you know, some kind, I don't even want to speak this stuff into the universe, but some kind of, you know, effort to, you know, revoke, you know, in-state tuition or access from, you know, undocumented folks who are trying to go to Kansas or state colleges. You know, if there was any kind of, you know, mass detention or roundup, that would be something where we would be looking for, you know, to do possible litigation. A number of other ACLU affiliates do have that being, you know, quite a big chunk of their work. And so, you know, I think it's kind of hard to anticipate what we would do just because I think we would try to be reactive and helpful, whether we were leading on it or supporting on it in just about any context where immigrant rights were being degraded. But I think those are kind of the big ones that we're, you know, on the lookout for.
Okay. And one other thing that I thought of, you mentioned the Safe and Welcoming stuff with Wyandotte County. Is that going to expand to other counties?
You know, if they're, I think, you know, we're definitely looking at that long term. You know, I think Wyandotte is certainly not the only county that would benefit from it. You mentioned Ford County earlier. Mm-hmm. That's a county where, you know, I think there's a lot of people who might be in a similar position to those folks here in Wyandotte who maybe don't have access to IDs and could use it. So, you know, we're definitely looking more broadly than just the Kansas City area at all times. And we would, you know, see if that made sense down the road.
And are there any cases or any lobbying that's going to be going on relating to religious freedom issues?
So that's a good question. We, I think, are always, I don't think we have any, we're not leading any lobbying on religious freedom issues. I'm sure that there are other progressive organizations that are maybe looking at the adoption bill that was passed last legislative session and looking to do, you know, some kind of repeal or fix on that law. So we're not leading on that. We would be tracking that and trying to be supportive where appropriate. And in terms of litigation, we're obviously always looking for people who may have been impacted by that law.
And what is the adoption bill?
So the adoption bill was essentially a bill that permitted religious adoption organizations or family organizations to, make discriminatory choices about child placement, you know, based if they were an LGBTQAI couple. So.
And is that, well, I guess for Laura Kelly to overturn that, she'd have to get the legislation repealed, right?
Right, yeah. Okay. And I don't know if there's much hope for that in the current legislature or not, so.
Okay. All right. And so I believe we're just about out of time. Is there any other issues that I haven't raised that you might be involved in?
No, I can't think of any, but I would say that in terms of our legislative priorities, we have a lobby day that we're planning at the state legislature on citizen participation in voting issues. So, you know, that kind of those legislative priorities that we talked about, the election day registration, you know, permanent advanced mail ballot voting. We're going to go and lobby legislators for that on January 24th. So if you're interested, check out our website.
Okay, and tell us what your website is.
It is www.aclukansas.org, And that's all one word.
And Kansas is spelled out.
Kansas is spelled out. Thank you.
Okay. .org. And is there also a phone number that they can call if they have any questions?
I'm trying to think of what our main line is. I believe it's 913-490-4100. And I apologize to any of my colleagues if that's their direct dial.
Okay. All right. So I want to thank you. For those who have just joined us, I've been talking to Lauren Bonds from the Kansas chapter of the ACLU. And coming up next is Counterspin. And after Counterspin is Viviana with Taste of Tiana. So thank you for joining us on Radioactive Magazine, and we will see you next week. Next week, David Mitchell interviews a guest, a professor from UMKC, who on global warming and climate change. Thank you for joining us.